Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, listeners may know that Donald Trump's big speech at the UN General Assembly was met with laughter. But another funny, not funny event that took place was largely overlooked. At a sort of glorified photo op, Trump announced a new plan for the world drug problem that reflects a return to inhumane and disproven approaches. We'll hear from Drug Policy Alliance's senior international policy manager, Hannah Hetzer, about what's going on. Also on the show, former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke is standing trial for first-degree murder for the 2014 killing of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. If convicted, he could face up to life in prison. Former Chicago police commander John Burge died September 19th. He was only convicted in civil suits, despite being responsible for years of systemic torture, coerced confessions, and violence visited on black communities. Van Dyke and Burge may be outliers, but coverage that treats them as rogues without interrogating the system that allows and abets their behavior is part of the problem. Counterspin talked about Burge's reign of terror with former Chicago Reader reporter John Conroy. And we talked with reporter and activist Jamie Calvin about Van Dyke's murder of McDonald. We'll hear part of both of those conversations today. That's coming up. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The September 20th Columbus Dispatch ran an op-ed from Jim Carroll, identified as Deputy Director of National Drug Control Policy and President Trump's nominee for Drug Czar. Carroll evinced concern for the lives lost to drug overdoses and empathy for the loved ones devastated by their loss, as well as those in recovery, all by way of explaining why he was in Columbus to meet with law enforcement officers from Ohio and across the Midwest about working together to stop heroin, fentanyl, cocaine, methamphetamine, and other drugs from entering our communities and ruining people's lives. That immediate recourse to a policing response is writ large in Trump's call to action on what his administration calls the world drug problem. But it doesn't reflect the direction of much of the actual world. So how much impact can that disconnect have? Hannah Hetzer is Senior International Policy Manager at Drug Policy Alliance. She joins us now by phone from here in town. Welcome to Counterspin, Hannah Hetzer.
Thank you for having me.
Well, as you have reported, the nature of the UN event at which this document, the Global Call to Action on the World Drug Problem, the nature of the event is itself telling. The UN has its maybe Byzantine ways, but this was still special. What was the story behind this less than 18-minute meeting?
Well, I think ultimately what this was just an attempt by Trump and his administration to have a photo op where they're surrounded by other countries that look like they're giving support to the administration and to demonstrate leadership on the drug issue without providing any real solutions, both domestically and internationally. So Trump hosted this high-level event that was called the Call to Action on the World Drug Problem, where he and U.S. Ambassador to the U.N., Nikki Haley, and U.N. Secretary General Guterres all gave remarks. At the event, Trump launched into, you know, very outdated 80s, 90s drug war rhetoric about a drug-free world, drug-free futures, about eradicating supply and the scourge of drug addiction, while Ambassador Haley just went on and on praising Trump for his leadership on this issue and saying he's ready to take this leadership worldwide. The event in itself, this rings so false because Trump has demonstrated no leadership on this issue domestically. He's actually ignored the advice of scientists, advocates, people from the medical profession about what actually works to help treat addiction and support people who use drugs and may be struggling, and has just enforced a very criminal justice heavy approach. connected to this event was a document called the Call to Action on the World Drug Problem, which the U.S. mission circulated to other U.N. member states, which was a one-page document. And there's several things wrong with this document. I mean, both the way it was circulated, which was, you know, is given to these countries saying this is not open for negotiation, it's a final document, and if they sign, they're invited to this event with Trump and can have this photo op with Trump. The U.N. is, I mean, as you said, it's very bureaucratic, but it does rest on the pillars of negotiation and consensus. So all documents are agreed upon, and other countries get to weigh in and negotiate the language. This just came out of nowhere and said it was final and non-negotiable. So it's very contrary to regular UN processes and also UN processes on drug policy, where there's several avenues for debate, and this is not one of them. There's also problems with the language of the letter. It doesn't mention key UN agencies like development program, or doesn't even mention development goals, the UNAIDS, the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and it kind of ignores some of the agreed upon language in the last few years at the UN about human rights, development, key populations, you know, women, children, and harm reduction strategies. It doesn't have the word harm reduction in it. So there's a problem with the language of the text. There's a problem with the way it was circulated. And ultimately, I think it was just a ploy by the administration to look like they're showing leadership on this issue.
Yeah, the non-mention of human rights seems central as we think about the impact that the drug war has had, you know. But there's not just, as media might lead a casual reader to think, there's not just this Trump worldview of things and then people who are only defined by their opposition to that. There is, in fact, a developed evidence-based conversation that runs counter in terms of the definition of the problem and in terms of the responses represented. And in fact, those views, as it happens, were showcased on the very day that Trump had his kind of dog and pony show.
That's right. So it's ironic that on the day that Trump had this event, former prime ministers and heads of state that make up the Global Commission on Drug Policy, this is a distinguished group of world leaders, the ex-presidents of Switzerland and Greece and Colombia and Brazil, together with people like Richard Branson and, before he passed away, Kofi Annan. They make up this Global Commission on Drug Policy, and on that very day, they were launching their report that's called Regulation, the Responsible Control of Drugs, where they call for an end to drug prohibition. They talk about the harms that drug prohibition has wreaked across the world and call for taking control of drugs through governments responsibly. And this is, you know, this isn't coming from grassroots activists. This is coming from people who used to hold high positions of power who you wouldn't think would necessarily be the ones presenting kind of these very innovative, groundbreaking strategies. But they have experience, and their language is just in such stark contrast to Trump's language. They're forward thinking. They've seen what hasn't worked. They're calling for new approaches that do work and for trying new things as well, while Trump just looks backwards. And then there's just also not a consensus within the UN member states. Unfortunately, a lot of countries signed on to this that, in, you know, domestically are more reform-oriented and probably did so out of a lot of heavy diplomatic pressure from the United States. It was unfortunate that Canada signed on, even though they are ramping up their harm reduction interventions, increasing the number of supervised consumption facilities, moving to legalize marijuana. And there are other countries that signed on to this that have much more progressive policies domestically, but probably just felt a lot of pressure from the Trump administration. And then there are countries that are, you know, engaging in brutal, lethal war on drugs. A good example is the Philippines, in which thousands of people have been killed in this drug war. And President Trump actually has praised the Philippine president for his approach. So there's a fractured consensus. There are countries that are more forward-thinking, and the U.S. is definitely trying to regain control of the debate and take us backwards.
Well, speaking of Philippine President Duterte, Donald Trump has he not even endorsed the idea or sort of floated the idea of executing drug dealers in this country?
That's right. It's so, I mean, it's terrifying. It's extremely worrying that not once but twice Trump has mentioned the idea of the death penalty for people who sell drugs. You know, it's concerning when you don't see human rights language being put first and foremost. It's incredibly frightening.
Well, I feel like sometimes in media, the human rights over the punitive approach is sort of set up as in this corner, you know. But for one thing, humaneness is good, you know. But for another, it's effective if our goal is individual and public health and well-being, you know. But I sometimes believe that many media conversations on this debate leave out what various parties would even define as winning. For some people, anybody who alters their consciousness in any way should be punished, you know, period. But we don't explore that. You know, there's a fundamental debate over the framing of whether this is a health issue or this is a morality issue, I think.
That's right. I mean, we've just seen the total failure of repressive policies. Prohibition, you know, and repression and punishment are unethical in and of themselves, but they also are inefficient. It doesn't work. And there are examples of strategies that do work, that do center public health and human rights and dignity and development. It's not just immoral, it's also inefficient.
Well, domestically, too, there are things happening in Ohio where I understand 12 people die each day from accidental overdoses. There's a conference September 27th and 28th that's talking about health-centered treatment, that's talking about harm reduction, terms that you note are missing from this Trump document. So we're having this conversation within this country as well of these varying approaches.
In localities, leaders and advocates are really being able to push through groundbreaking strategies that were almost not conceivable in this country up until now. The big example of that right now is the discussion around supervised consumption facilities, which is taking place in a number of cities around this country. And this is not a new crazy idea globally. There are many countries that have supervised consumption facilities, many cities, and there has never been a single overdose death in any of them. They've been peer-reviewed. There's evidence that these work to support people who are using drugs, that they lower the rates of infectious diseases, of overdose deaths. They're incredibly effective and they're incredibly humane. And I think, you know, now we're at a point where in desperation, a lot of cities are finally accepting the words of people who use drugs and people who advocate for people who use drugs to say that this is what we want and this is what works. And it looks like we're gonna be able to open one in this country over the coming year, which is very exciting. But we also need to scale up other programs that have proven to work, like syringe exchange programs, the availability of naloxone, all of these harm reduction strategies that have worked elsewhere and here.
Media could be playing a role in letting folks know that those things are possible and happening.
Absolutely, which is why I'm very thankful that you're hosting this program, because again, this is not sort of inventing the wheel. These are proven strategies, and the more that's presented as viable and helpful, the better. And if we think about the amount of resources that we pour into prohibition and law enforcement that could go to treatment and support and harm reduction, we would just be in a much better place.
Well, I don't want to close without noting the maybe most recent sort of positive step as we record, which is that the CITSA Act, the Stop the Importation and Trafficking of Synthetic Analogs Act of 2017, that the House passed in July, I understand it was kept out of the final congressional bill on opioids. So something that would have kind of pushed things in the more punitive direction that we're talking about, it sounds like has been halted for the moment.
There are these little glimmers of hope, because I think people are becoming more sensitized to this issue. So that is a small victory, yes.
We've been speaking with Hannah Hetzer, Senior International Policy Manager at Drug Policy Alliance. You can find their work online at drugpolicy.org. Hannah Hetzer, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me.
The trial of former Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke continues this week. Van Dyke charged with first-degree murder for killing Laquan McDonald in October of 2014, firing 16 shots into the 17-year-old who was moving away from him. A former head of Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police, attending Van Dyke's trial, took a moment to remember another officer, John Burge, who died on September 19th. Former Commander Burge, with a gang of his cops known as the Midnight Crew, terrorized communities of color and engaged in the systemic torture of more than 100 black men. At Van Dyke's trial, former FOP President Dean Angelo told the assembled media, quote, John Burge put a lot of bad guys in prison. You know, people picked a career apart that was considered for a long time to be an honorable career and a very effective career, close quote. Media, too, were circumspect, with obituary headlines describing Burge as disgraced or suggesting he was linked to torture rather than guilty of it. Bringing attention to the murder of Laquan McDonald and horrific abuses of John Burge was the work not of the state, but of activists and community members. And both cases involved reporters, not so much the media, but individual and somewhat outsider reporters who played important roles in moving the stories toward daylight, if not yet accountability. With Burge, critical reporting was done by John Conroy, who worked the story for decades for the Chicago Reader. When Counterspin spoke with Conroy in December of 2007, the Reader, like many outlets, was in cost-cutting mode, and he had been laid off. We asked him how he came to the story.
It began for me at the trial, a civil suit filed in federal court here in Chicago of a man named Andrew Wilson, who was suing some police officers, detectives, and a high-ranking commander, as well as the city, claiming he had been tortured. And Andrew Wilson had shot dead two police officers in 1982. And so when the trial began, it was clear he had really no chance. He was an African-American man who had never learned to read. He had a long career as an armed robber and had committed other crimes. And he was testifying against a group of decorated policemen, one of them a Vietnam War hero, and they were very accustomed to testifying while Wilson was not. I sat in on the trial, and during the course of it, some anonymous letters started arriving at the offices of Wilson's attorneys, and the letters came in police department envelopes, and they indicated that Wilson, who had claimed that he had been given electric shock, had indeed been given electric shock, and that the machines used had been used on other prisoners. And the letters directed the lawyers to talk to a man named Melvin Jones, who was then in Cook County Jail. And when they got to Jones, Jones said, oh, yeah, the same thing happened to me. And it turned out it happened about 5 days before Wilson was arrested. And Jones said, I actually talked about this in 1983, you could pull the transcript. And so they pulled the transcript, and lo and behold, the lawyer asked Jones, what did John Burge, the commander, say to you while this was going on? And he said, did I know Satan and Cochise? And I said, I knew them, but I didn't know them well. And Burge said, well, they were crawling on the floor when I did this to them. So the lawyers then went and found Satan and Cochise, and sure enough, they knew all about this electric torture and pointed them to other victims. And over the course of the next 15 to 20 years, a list was built up of more than 100 men who'd been given electric shock, had been suffocated with plastic bags and typewriter covers. Mock executions had been conducted. Some had been beaten really severely. And a small group of detectives and a commander who had done it.
How, we asked, did the local media do on the case?
Well, the local press is at a disadvantage in that the reporters have to cover the whole federal building. So they run in and out of several trials. And there happened to be another trial going on at the time of a sports agent. And this involved testimony of some celebrities. And as a result, I was really the only journalist who sat through the whole Andrew Wilson trial and then sat through it again because it had ended in a mistrial. So the local press didn't notice that the police changed their defense from the first trial to the second. In the first trial, the police said Wilson couldn't have been burned on that radiator because the radiator in that interrogation room never worked. And in the second trial, they said Wilson burned himself on that same radiator, and the reason why we know this is that we have a jailhouse informant. The jury didn't know that this guy had a long record of fraud, an international record of fraud and perjury, in addition to other crimes. But nonetheless, I was the only one who really spotted that. And so when my story came out, my editors thought that would be the end of it, that the dailies would run with this now, and nobody did. It did get noticed by the Office of Professional Standards, a police department body that investigates excessive force, and they reopened their investigation and later cited my story as a starting point. And in 1993, Burge was thrown off the force, but that was really treated as a one-day story. Burge thrown off the force over torture charges, and in part it was because the police board issued a very vaguely worded statement in which they never said Burge had tortured anybody. And so the next story I did had to do with the lack of concern about the victims. It was called Town Without Pity, and it was really pointed out how the city, knowing that torture had occurred, was willing to look the other way, even though there were men on death row who would be executed unless somebody looked at their cases, and they were there on the basis of tortured confessions.
Was it that reporters were just in some measure of disbelief about such horrible charges?
I think that's the case. I think, too, that nobody cared about Andrew Wilson. He was a cop killer, and a lot of people thought, you know, he got what he deserved if he got it. And I think that's one of the lessons here, that in every society there's a torturable class. And in Chicago at that time, the torturable class was African Americans, most of them with criminal records.
That was John Conroy speaking with Counterspin in 2007. His reporting on police torture in Chicago is still available at chicagoreader.com. Independent journalist Jamie Calvin's article for Slate, called 16 Shots, testified against the tale Chicago law enforcement were telling about the killing of 17-year-old African-American Laquan McDonald. When Counterspin talked with Calvin in December 2015, he implicated media in the bigger picture of police abuse.
The media is part of the same machinery as the police department's false narrative about individual instances like the Laquan McDonald case and larger macro narrative about the state of the city. And so, you know, part of what is, I think, getting lost right now, and understandably given the extreme and egregious nature of what I think can only be called the execution of Laquan McDonald, is that this is not a huge departure from the norm. I mean, this is the norm. So on October 20th of last year, the police-involved shooting, so-called, of a black teenager on the Southwest Side was treated by the media on the basis of information solely provided by the police department and a spokesperson for the Fraternal Order of Police, the police union, as, you know, a kind of routine story of officer self-defense. A young man with a knife lunges at officer, is shot in the chest, dies sometime later. Completely uncritical response, a police shooting almost invariably about 80-85% of the time of an African-American. That's a story that recurs between 40 and 50 times a year in Chicago. We as journalists do not, unless there are exceptional circumstances, dig into the story to, you know, do the hard work on the scene, in the neighborhood, to find out what happened. To this day, even in this post-Ferguson era, the tendency is just to publish the police blotter. I don't want to exclude myself from that indictment of the press. I was brought to this story not by my own hunch or insight or intuition about what had happened here, but by a whistleblower who reached out to a colleague of mine, Craig Futterman, a civil rights lawyer, and myself, with a tip a couple of weeks after the shooting to the effect that the facts were sharply at variance with the official account, that there was video, And he was in a position close enough to the investigation to say that he was concerned that this was not going to be vigorously investigated.
We hear about the police code of silence. Calvin suggested an expansion of that idea.
A lot of different things have entered into, you know, Ferguson concerns, the mayor's reelection, but also I think just the culture of how the police department responds. And I've said this repeatedly in recent weeks, that what's really striking, if you look at just all the different acts, including officers at the scene and then how the investigative process was handled, at every stage and at every level of the police department and the city, in response to this utterly appalling incident, the impulse, the default, just the cultural reflex was to circle the wagons and to double down on what they absolutely had to know was a false narrative. So, you know, there's a lot of talk in Chicago now about conspiracy and cover-up, and I think those words have their place, but I think they're also misleading. And I think what we're confronting is something in some ways more disturbing, which is the culture. You know, we talk about the code of silence, which is one of those really resonant phrases, and it's very evocative because there is, in fact, a kind of coerced silence of police officers who witness abuses but are intimidated into silence by fear of retaliation. And I think there's also silence of victims who know they won't be believed and won't be taken seriously. So the term makes some sense, but there's another sense in which it's really inapt, because what something like Laquan McDonald incident reflects, and I think it's an instance of a much, much broader phenomena, is an absolute fierce effort to maintain narrative control.
Right.
And so the code of silence is a tool in the service of narrative control. And to come back to the press, that I think is where we have not been as effective as we might be in penetrating and piercing that dynamic. And it's critical to do so. I mean, how many other Laquan McDonalds are there?
That was Jamie Calvin. Before that, we heard John Conroy. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the media watch group FAIR, based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Erica Rosato. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.